We've effectively got life stories in the morning, which is great. And again, welcome to you, Bongo.
Thank you.
It's great to have you here with us. And we're going to find out a bit about him this morning. And just in case you weren't convinced whether or not to come this afternoon, I'm sure after hearing him here this morning, and of course getting the bonus song that I wasn't expecting, that you'll be down here this afternoon at 3 o'clock. That'll be good. All right. We're hoping that loads of the youth group kids will come, bring their families as well. So we're hoping and praying. So that'd be good. So some up-to-date stuff then, just so that we find out who this man is. Clive here, otherwise known as Bongo Clive. We met at a Care for the Family event at Mina Don only last year. So Care for the Family use Mina Don as a venue. They send representatives from the charity. So back in 2017, Bongo and his wife Julie came along working for the charity, and we got to know each other and became good mates, which is great. And then you were back again this year, which is even more of an encouragement. People actually come back. That's fantastic. And during those visits to Mina Don with those families from the Care for the Family charity, you ran what's known as the Rhythm Shack. So Bongo Clive's Rhythm Shack is a pretty famous thing. Okay. Now, if you just share with us, just tell us about what all that is, what the work you do, the places you get to go to, and how the work that you do helps the people that you get to meet. Just tell us a bit about
okay,
it.
Okay, yeah. Well, Bongo's Rhythm Shack started. We moved to West Wales in Tenby from southwest London in December 93. And I came with a set of bongos, an acoustic guitar, young family. Daughter was less than a year old, son was 11. And apparently they prayed for a new family, a young family, and they also prayed for a drummer. So can I just say, whenever we pray for things, you know, don't be surprised at the packaging. Okay. They thought they were going to have a nice white family turn up and a drummer that plays a drum kit. They had this big, I was 15 and a half stone then at the time, this great big Russian hat and a hoodie. And our first experience of going into the church, it was Christmas time, the lights were dim, the candles were flickering. I sat there in the pew, and the lady looked at me and she grabbed her handbag. No, that's fine. She's a good friend of mine now. But, you know. So anyway, we were in Deer Park Baptist Church in Tenby for a while. And, you know, I get excited about wanting to tell people about Jesus because of just what he's doing in my life. So, and then we're in the hall below the church, and suddenly I just had this idea, yes, that Daddy wanted to set this place up and have young people come and play their instruments. So, and I felt very much the call to do that. So anyway, I brought it to the church leadership. They ummed and ahed about it. All the time they were pausing on it, this thing was welling up in me. I knocked on the door again, and eventually let me do it. And the first night that it opened up, all I had was one bass guitar, similar to what Phil's got, same make, and an amp that was given to me in 1985, bass guitar and the amp by Christian. He said, I know this is going to be in good hands, but I didn't have a clue. So I've got this bass guitar, and I've got a set of bongos and an acoustic guitar. 32 young people came through the door that night. Five loaves and two fishes. That's stretching it a bit, isn't it? So I had no experience. And of course, it ran for 11 months. I called it the Rhythm Shack. Just felt, and I even had a logo. I designed a logo for it. And it's still going to this day. And what happened was, so that ran for 11 months. And then there's a place called the Stackpole Centre in Pembroke. And it's a respite centre for people with disabilities. My name got referred to there. They gave me a little music room. Schools were then come in with their children with additional needs. And so that ran for a while. Then I joined, whilst that was running, I joined an agency in Carmarthen. That then put me into care homes, residential homes, also mental health wards. I started to run music sessions in the mental health arena. So it kind of went on and on and on. The Rhythm Shack is still going. You know the song King of Kings, Majesty? Well, Jared Cooper, who wrote that song, was speaking in the church we were in Narberth. And I just finished playing bass in the worship, and he looked at me and said, I've just had a word from the Lord for you. God's going to use you mightily in the schools, and finances are not going to be a problem. Well, I knew finances weren't going to be a problem because December 98, Daddy removed a £48,000 debt off my head from a building society. And they said, Mr. Edwards, we've looked at your situation. We're prepared to give a special concession. If you can come up with £1,000 in 8 weeks, we will accept it as full and final payment of your debt. And even the £1,000 was given to me by a friend, and I didn't even know. It's a whole load of stories. We've all got the stories. We need to dig them up and read them again. Keep journals.
Yeah.
And so then the schools opened up. And that's, so I've been a community musician since May 95. I still get bookings in schools. I do lots of kiddies parties, lots of nurseries and play groups. And I'm also now in Swansea Prison. So I was in Cardiff Prison working for 2.5 years through an organisation called Changing Tunes, who are based in Bristol. They send musicians into prisons. And so I've literally just finished working in Cardiff. I'm now closer to home working in Swansea. I've got a little prison band. They call themselves No Escape. that's their name. We did a little gig in the chapel for an award giving ceremony, and it's amazing what's happening.
Yeah, fantastic. And of course, the name Bongo with the drums and so on. But there was a youth group that got that name, and it Nayland, stuck, didn't they? Yeah?
Your Josh will know about Nayland. Nayland is a place. In Pembrokeshire, and at the time, way back in 96, I was doing some work with a youth group up there. And they had lots of problems up there, lots of lads not really knowing what to do with their time, so getting up to all sorts of mischief. But I remember sitting there, and they just had a recording studio built. So I'm doing a music session, doing a little rock school with them, and I had my bass, and I said to one of them, I said, I'm going to be playing the bass tomorrow in church. I went, what? You play the bass in church? I went, oh, yeah, in church. What, in the chapel? I goes, well, it's in the church. And they couldn't believe it. And these guys were like 15-year-olds. But as we were doing percussion stuff, they were the ones that called me Bongo Clive. And so it stuck. And I will say that I don't particularly like my name Clive. Okay, but... Because you can tell me off. You can say Clive, and you can tell me off. Pete can tell me off and say Clive. But I'd like to see him tell me off and say Bongo. He'd be like, now Bongo.
Nah, it doesn't work, does it?
No, so Clive. There you go. Yeah.
And a lot of this all started off with a gift of £20 from your father. Mm. And just talk us through, if you will, why were you asking for that gift? And where was your dad?
Okay,
at the
can
time?
I've asked the lady at the back if she'd show a picture of my dad holding me.
All right.
So that's my dad. My parents came over from Jamaica in the 50s. For any of you who know the history of the stuff, you know, Jamaica and the Caribbean was under British rule. They considered themselves British subjects. And so when they were invited to come and help build up Britain after the war, and to take on jobs a lot of white people didn't want to take. So you had these hard-working people. My dad was a strapping man. And so I'm the oldest of three. And, you know, I look at that picture, I think to myself, he must have had real hopes for his eldest son. You know, you hold your child and you think, wow, there's things I'd like to see my child move into, and hopefully I can help make that happen. But what happened was my parents separated when I was very young, and mum took us off to London, and I ended up in a children's home, and it was all rocky from there. I spent a short time with my dad. He came and got us out, my sister and I, out of a children's home, and I was living with my dad, and then he said he was going to start life somewhere else. Do I want to come with him? Do I want to stay with mum? I said, I'll stay with my mum. Mum had a boyfriend. It was all a bit rocky. So I was running away from home about 6, 7 year old, sleeping in people's front gardens. And then I ended up in a series of children's homes. The last children's home I was in when I was nine years old, was a Christian-run children's home in Broadstairs, Kent. Mm. And so I've been all over the place. Mm. Right? Ding, ding, ding. And that was an amazing place. It was run by a couple, Mr. and Mrs. Widmer. It was a home called Fegan's Homes. And Mr. Widmer was... They were born in India, so these guys were from white colonial India. Okay, they spoke very well, and the cravats and everything. He was a captain in the Gurkhas, so he was a serious man. You just, you know, in those days, we got the cane if we were wrong. You know, it's not good. But he was a serious man, and so they used to march us off to the Methodist church every Sunday, so we were literally like a platoon. Everybody knew the Fegan's boys, you know? And I can remember being in the Methodist church and just hearing the gospel when I was 9 years old. So, and came back. It really made an impact on me. Mrs. Wimmer led me to the Lord. So around about 11 years old, I had a friend of mine who was Simon. He was his parents ran a guest home. He was a very clever guy. We were best of mates. He got a guitar. He taught me to play G, E minor, C, D. So I wanted a guitar, saw this music shop, and it had a guitar lent up in a corner. It was a Cream guitar, a Telecaster copy. And I can remember pushing my face up against the glass when I was coming home from school. I want that guitar. And the chap in the shop was like, get your nose off my glass. I want that guitar. And do you know, I still got that guitar at home. It still works. £16 brand new. I said to my dad, can you send me 16 quid to get a guitar? He was now in Canada, remarried. So he sent me £20 and he said, I hope you get change. And and that's how it started. And I've still got that guitar.
Yeah. But a difficult, a far from easy life from the different homes, one to the next, to the next then, yeah.
Yeah.
And you eventually moved to Anglesey, didn't you?
That's right.
Bit of a contrast.
Well, the thing was, moving out, getting out, me out of London,
yeah,
and being part of the coast and the woods and making dens in the bush and doing all the stuff that boys are supposed to do and like to do. In London, it was a different scene in any built-up area. Mm. So, you know, I often, as I get older now, I look back on those memories. They were a real source of strength for me. It was where I was given my first push bike. Mm-hmm. And I still got the scar underneath there where I went tearing. I only had one brake. And for those of you who have ever ridden a bike, if you got one brake, where do you want the brake to be, front or back? At the back. Where was mine? At the front. And I can remember hacking off down this, you know, down this alleyway that we later on used to go to school quite regularly, and I didn't know where I was going, but I was so excited about having this bike. And then I came out of the alleyway and I went down this road in a really plush residential area, and I pulled the front brake and I just went woo, and I just met with the ground, and I had this horrible hole in here that they thought they'd have to stitch up. And this man had a Rolls Royce, a maroon Rolls Royce. I remember the car. He picked up my bike, lifted the boot that looked like a cave, put the bike in there, put me on the back seat, and he said, where are you from? I said, Sunny Home. He said, I know the place, and he took me back.
Oh,
so, yeah, amazing. And it's, you know, Sunny Home is just a special place for me.
Yeah. And that's helped you to have a liking for this type of area, really,
I
isn't
love it.
You
know? And from there, I was part of Sea Scouts.
Mm.
Although I'd get seasick on a little boat. But I fell in love with the beach. They had Viking Bay. And if anybody knows about Broadstairs, you've got Bleak House, Viking Bay. It's beautiful. And then when I was 14, obviously, they were trying to plan out what you want to do with your life and everything. So the only thing I could think of, really, was that I liked the water. So Mr. Widmer sourced this school in Anglesey. It was called TS Indefatigable. It's quite a long name to have in gold around your white hat. I think you went all the way round because it's so many words, so many letters. You have to walk round the sailor just to read it. But and they sent me up there. There were two schools. One was HMS Conway. They were rather sort of they spoke like that, you know. And we were all the rough and ready. So we had the Scousers, the Cockneys, and the Welsh boys. And I can remember when we used to go to Bangor on leave. we'd be just walking around the town, and little old Welsh ladies would touch our collars, because apparently it was good luck to touch a sailor's collar. Freaked me out the first time it happened. I said, what?
Mid-teens, you go back to London, and it's not an easy time. You have a stay in prison as well.
Well, the thing was, I was in the Merchant Navy for a while.
Yeah.
So I was in Shell Tankers, and that was great fun at 16. And then came out, parents were really worried about ship sinking and everything else. And so anyway, I came out after a short time, trip to the Persian Gulf, Mediterranean, which was great. Started to work around London, and I started to ride motorbikes. Okay, I always seem to do things that other groups weren't doing at the time. So there were no black guys riding motorbikes back in the 70s. You, not one. You find them all over the shop now, you know. But so I fell in love with motorbikes, and the place that I was working, there was a mate of mine called Ricky and a guy called Huggy Bear, and we all had 125s. We thought we were the bee's knees. And then, yeah, so we'd go on trips and stuff and just really enjoy ourselves. And I was just living the life as a young person. It was great. But what was happening was that there was a lot of racism that was coming up around that time. And I had a little puppy that was part Alsatian and part Labrador. I remember walking her out one night, and a guy and his girl, white girl, and a guy in their car. And she said, "Oh, look at his lovely puppy." And so he said something derogatory to me. So I showed him the finger. He reversed the car on the pavement and aimed the car at me. So I ended up on the bonnet, and my puppy was nearly underneath the car. So there was a number of events. I got chased down by a couple of guys. I was in Biggenhill Airfield for an air show with my mate Rick on the back of his bike. Seven white guys attacked us. One was going to glass my face. So in the end, I'm thinking to myself, this is not good. So I had to carry a knife to protect myself. I even had a police officer in Brixton, as I came out of a party one day, telling me to walk my bike because I didn't have L plates. I had provisional, but I didn't have L plates. And, you know, when you're 18 years old, you're pretty cocky, you know. But that's no excuse for somebody to say that he would like to put his truncheon across my head and have me done for a police assault and a police officer. And I just thought, wow. I looked at him and I thought to myself, when you go home after your shift, your kids are going to run up to you, hug you, daddy's home, you're going to kiss your wife, and you would do that to somebody else's child. I just didn't get it. So anyway, I carried a knife. I ended up using it. And prior to that, I got knocked off my bike. I went up to a mate's house in Peckham, and I said to my mate, "Oh, I'll give you a lift to Brixton." And I said, "I'll go and get a helmet." So I jokingly said to him, "If you hear of a pile-up on Brixton Hill, it's me." Oh, my gosh. I came out of the estate. It was about 8:45 at night. It was sort of dusk. It must have been the summertime. And I saw these headlamps come in. And next thing you know, I had a 250 Honda, which was the same size as a 400 at the time. And the car clipped the back of my bike. I went down. I just remember the indicator of my bike going, ping. And when I stopped rolling and I went to get up, my leg was absolutely broken from here all the way down. All the bones were broken, sticking out, and my foot was facing that way. So I couldn't, you know, like an action man, you know, the toys? It was just like that, it was. And so I passed out. Anyway, so not only, and that was after I'd used the knife, so now I'm on bail. I've nearly lost my leg. It was crazy. But I've got no pins in this leg. In Guy's Hospital, they said they've never had... this is the best leg they've had for 2 years. I had no pins whatsoever, no problems with it. Wow. On traction for a long time. So, of course, when I'm now in court, and then I was on remand, so I'm doing step-ups in the cell to build my leg up because I had no physio. And then eventually I got sentenced to 2 years... So I was in Wormwood Scrubs. And I can remember sitting in the cell thinking, "Oh my gosh, what's going on with my life?" And so I just felt I needed to seek God. So I went along to the Anglican church, and they had like a worship group come in back then. And I was sitting there, you know, you're desperate, aren't you? You're desperate just to find some sort of direction. And all I could hear was, psst, psst, and they want you to pass tobacco tins behind with smoke and whatever else from one wing to the other. And I can remember sitting there thinking, they've got no respect in the house of God. So I came out of there, and I remember looking through the window of the Roman Catholic Church, and I don't want to offend anybody whose background is Roman Catholicism, but it just looked like loads of gold goblets and everything, you know. I just thought, great, that's not for me. And I was walking around the exercise yard, and another black guy called Tony said to me that Islam is the black man's religion. And of course, when you're hurting, you know, I was born in Sheffield. I'm being told to go back to your own country, your coon, your nigger, and I'm just thinking, stone the crows. You know, it really rocks you. So when I was told that Islam was a black man's religion, you know, you're desperate to grab hold of anything. And so I converted to Islam when I was in prison, changed my name to Abdullah Sharif, was reading lots of Nation of Islam books, Malcolm X stuff. I really was just soaking up all the wrong stuff, to be quite honest, and becoming quite racist in my thinking, in myself. Which was really interesting. And I can remember saying to myself, I made this adamant pledge in myself. There's no way I'm going to ever, you know, meet a white girl and marry a white guy. And if I could see the veins in her legs, whoa. And can you just put a picture of my wife up on the screen, please? That's my wife, Julie. And she, as dark as I am dark, as she is white. You don't get her much whiter than Gigi. And Peter, Susie, and Beth, and, you know, she's
wonderful.
She's wonderful. And, you know, I came out of prison in 1980 on parole, a staunch Muslim. I wore Muslim clothing. I just thought Christianity is for white people. I started going to the mosque. I was hanging out with guys in the Muslims, and I was really connecting with people. I even went on a thing called Tabligh Jamaat, where you would go. I'd go to East London, where you would encourage Muslims to come to church. to come to mosque. And so I was really, whatever I believed in, I really wanted to throw my all into it, you know. And I really thought I'd found the truth. But then there were some things started to surface in that. And I came out of that. And I thought, okay, well, Christianity ain't got it because it's for the white people. Islam ain't got it. There's some dodgy. I'm just going to do my own thing. So I'm kind of back into doing my own thing. So I had to build my life up, obviously, on parole. So I started, I was working in Sutton, cleaning the base of petrol stations and filling people's cars with fuel. In those days, you could pull into Shell Garage and you had a pump attendant.
Yeah.
Okay, remember the days. So this is around about 1980, 1981. And I knew that I had to, in order to build my life up, I had to start right at the bottom again. So that's what I did. And then the manageress, she gave me a night cashier job. Mm-hmm. And I knew then that once I get a reference from her, not that I went to prison because of dodgy dealing with money or whatever, but I've got a record, so I need to build myself up. And then I joined a manpower services training, 6 months training, learned to make stencils for screen printers. Then I got a screen printing job, and then it kind of just all built up from there. So now this is now mid-85. I'm drumming in reggae bands. I'm going to work and doing shifts in screen printing. I'm clubbing. My life is okay. I'm having a good time. And then around about 1988, I'm getting a bit fed up. I'm working in nightclubs as a bouncer as well. Mm-hmm. And I worked for some celebrities. I don't know if you guys remember, anybody remember Bross? Yeah. Right, well, I looked after those guys for about 3 weeks, in their cars, in their hotels with them and everything, with Matt. And so, you know, I'd say to people, they say, well, how did it change? When things were good until they weren't for me. So that's how it's gone. Gets to a point where I just don't want to do it anymore, and what can I do? And I can remember being in this nightclub, and I'm having a great time, but then I'm starting to not have a great time. I'm just thinking, I don't like this life. I don't know this. I don't know that. I want to get out of it. And I can remember praying in this nightclub, Lord, Give me a wife that doesn't have to do all this to enjoy herself. Now, I don't know what kind of prayer that is. What kind of prayer is that? Oh, she can bungee in a bikini if she wants, but I don't want her doing this. Which wasn't a nice, it wasn't a dodgy club.
Yeah.
It's just a crazy prayer, isn't it? But, and then I met Julie, and
she was in the club.
She was working, yeah. She was in the club. She used to come there in the club.
Yeah.
And it was a kind of club where I was dressed just in civvies. It wasn't like Dickie Bell and stuff, so people didn't know you were security. But I used to stand right by the steps coming down, and I just did loads of cartoons. For these guys now, I do cartoons.
He's a cartoonist as well.
So yeah, I just drew loads of cartoons for her. That's the way to win the lady of your dreams, isn't it? Just draw her a cartoon. Job done.
Depends what you draw, I suppose. Oh, fantastic. And of course, you spent a long time, you just talked and talked with Julie, didn't you?
Yeah. And I mean, if she was here, she would tell you this. That I think she's told these guys is that after 3 days, she proposed to me. Mm. I told her I had a son from a previous relationship and told her about my prison sentence and everything else. And I kind of knew then that this wasn't like a club romance. There was something deeper going on here. So I took the letter, showed my mum, and that was 1989. So we ended up moving in together, and Julie had a house, and there was another story there. And she worked for a software company in London, in the West End. And so we started to plan life together. And then in 1991, Valentine's Day, we got married. So at the registry office in Wandsworth. And things were starting to, you know, I was thinking to myself, you know, I've got a good woman now and I can see my way forward. Me and her can put heads together. And, you know, we put our trust in people, don't we? And because we put our trust in ourselves sometimes, our own abilities, and that don't work. And then we get somebody and we bank it on them and that don't work. And we think it's stone of crows. It's the lottery next. No. and we had plans and everything. And then all of a sudden, Daddy starts moving on us. And invited my cousin round for a meal, and I hadn't seen her. I don't know whether it's because of my childhood with children's homes and everything, but, you know, families never really kind of mattered that much to me, in the sense that, you know, I'd see them, I'd surface for a while, I'd see them, I'd connect, and then I'd disappear for a bit. So it's a bit like that. It was just up and down. So anyway, we invited my cousin round, and I wanted her to meet Julie. We didn't talk about God or anything. So my cousin went. About 2 weeks later, I just had this feeling that I want to go to her church. So I phoned her up. I says, Lorraine. She said, yeah. I said, it's Cousin Clive. She went, all right, how you doing? I said, I'm good. I said, look, we want to come to your church. There was silence. I went, Lorraine? She went, yeah. I said, did you hear what I said? She went, yeah. She must have been going, either jumping around the room going like this, or she must have flaked out. I don't know. But anyway, we went along to Wimbledon Baptist Church the following Sunday. And we went with our suits, our wedding suits and everything. And there was like 400 people in the church. And they would just look like you lovely people, just relaxed and chilled in the presence of God, worshipping. And we stood there, and just this atmosphere of Jesus. And we didn't hear the preaching, there was no altar call. It's Daddy's time to bring us home, to just call him to himself, call us to himself. And the assistant pastor and a guy called Errol, who's a Welsh guy, moved to London. They just said, look, would you like some coffee or, you know, refreshments? We said, yeah. They sat there, and they must have seen the Holy Spirit all over us. And they just said, would you like to give your heart to the Lord? Before they finished the sentence, the sprinklers came on. I wept, man.
Amazing.
And so that was around about February. They led us to the Lord. It must have been the easiest job they've ever done. Because we were like on a slippery slope, I think. They took us through a nurture program. Should have been 8 weeks. It went on twice as long because my wife has got questions. She's an administrator. She has questions. And so then we got to the part about the baptism. We both got baptized together. And then shortly after that, December 93, we moved to West Wales.
Yeah. Fantastic. Amazing. Wonderful.
Can I just say, I was sitting there earlier on, you know, and sometimes in the past, you know, I've been a Christian since 91, and I've had opportunities to speak and stuff, and, you know, you see your photo on a poster or something, and you can feel a little bit like, oh, you know, you don't want to be the center of attention. But I want to tell you something. The atmosphere of this place points people to Jesus anyway. So whoever's face is on here to speak is not a big deal. They can relax. I can totally relax because you guys are just, you're thinking about the King. Does that make sense? So I'm not getting in the way having Bongo's face on it. It's not being, Daddy just says, you've got to be able to handle it because my son is being glorified here. So it's great. So keep on keeping on. Keep pointing people to him. Just keep your hearts on him.
Yeah, brilliant. Thank you.
He's great, isn't he?
Yeah, too right. Okay, good job. Thank you. All right, back to you then.